Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. I always invite listeners to visit the site for the latest material on it, and there is always new material that needs to be looked at, read, reflected on, a treasure trove of very important information. Today, my guest is John Dugard. John is a South African-born international law professor, now teaching in the U.S. From 2001 until March last year, he was the U.N.'s Special Human Rights Rapporteur for Occupied Palestine. He's also a rare public official, and the reason he's praised by people like me and very severely criticized by people who don't want the material that he put out in his role. They prefer the sanitized version. And listeners to this program know that discussing occupied Palestine is a core issue. We've discussed it many times, especially since last December, December 27th, the 22 days when those attacks took place, Operation Cast Lead. John can't discuss that program because he visited Gaza recently, and he's putting together a report from it, but it's not published yet, so we can't talk about it until it is published. Although we may get into any or whatever issues today, John, I welcome you to the program, and I'll let you lead on what you can discuss, and I'll follow, and we'll pursue things that I think are important to both of us. A very warm welcome to you, John.
Good morning, Stephen. Thank you very much for those kind words of introduction. I'm prepared to discuss virtually anything concerning both the West Bank and Gaza, but I would find it very difficult to talk about my views on the consequences of Israel's action in Gaza at the end of last year, because, as you rightly said, I am preparing a report on the implications under international criminal law for this action. But I will indicate if you ask me any question as to whether I can answer it or not.
Well, a year ago, almost to the day, John, I wrote an article in great detail discussing a report you put out in January 2008. And the title I used was Human Rights Violations in Occupied Palestine, a UN assessment. It was your assessment, very detailed. And you were very clear on what you saw after visiting Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, Ramallah, Bethlehem, or a number of other cities. And you were very critical, very honest. It's what I write about all the time, John. I am a Jew who believes that I simply can't tolerate things like this in my name, nor should any one of us. We're talking about very grievous human rights violations, as you well know. I've never been to Gaza or the West Bank, but you certainly have spent a fair amount of time there. Thankfully, you weren't treated the way Richard Falk was on his recent attempt to get in. But who knows what's coming. That music, John, means that we have a commercial break coming. Let's take that, and we'll come back and we'll get into some of this. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
John Dugard, former UN Special Human Rights Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine. We're talking about what happened there during John's tenure before the end of last year when the latest conflict erupted. John, I've discussed this with distinguished guests like yourself so often on this program, and I strongly believe, and others have had the same feeling, that short of an equitable resolution to this long-running, festering situation, I don't see much chance for peace overall in the Middle East. The governments of other Arab countries may go along with what's happening. They're either cowed or bought off to do it. But certainly the Arab street is very uneasy about this, and I don't think it gets any better. Sooner or later, I would think push would come to shove, and things might get uglier than they've been up to now. But we're getting close to 42 years of occupation in Gaza, in the West Bank, not to mention since 1948, Israel's so-called War of Independence, that took the homeland away from a people very violently. You know it so well, John, from the years, for about 7 years that you were there for the UN. Maybe you can talk about your experiences, what you saw, and so on.
Well, I used to visit the Palestinian territory twice a year, both the West Bank and Gaza. And the human rights violations differ according to the territory. In the West Bank, the most serious problems are the construction of settlements. Today there are nearly 500,000 settlers in the West Bank. And then there's the construction of the so-called security wall, which seizes over 10% of the Palestinian territory and incorporates some of the most arable agricultural land into Israel, and also incorporates settlements into Israel. And then there are over 600 checkpoints in the West Bank, which seriously impede Palestinian freedom of movement. And this, of course, has had a major impact on the fabric of Palestinian life. It has generated a humanitarian crisis, one which to some extent is overcome by foreign donors who have given generously to the Palestinian Authority. But one must accept that Israel is not only guilty of serious violations of human rights law, but Israel also fails in its responsibility as occupying power to care for the welfare of the Palestinian people. When it comes to Gaza, the situation is different because Israel and the West have determined that Hamas is a terrorist organization and that it should be subjected to a siege. So one sees a closure of the borders between Israel and Gaza, and also between Egypt and Gaza, with the result that the people of Gaza are in effect imprisoned, strangled and imprisoned. And since 2006, when Hamas took control of Gaza, we've seen increased military action by the Israeli Defense Forces in Gaza. Most obviously, the recent attack on the 27th of December, which lasted for 22 days, which was seriously the most, certainly the most serious military incursion into the territory, which resulted in some 1,400 deaths and over 5,000 injuries. The situation in Gaza is bleak, to put it mildly. I'm very concerned not only about Israel's role, but also about the role of the international community. I think it's imperative that the international community start to talk to the Hamas government in Gaza, because until that happens, it will be impossible to create a government of Palestinian national unity, and also be possible to bring about a state of peace between Gaza and Israel. It's really quite bizarre that the West refuses to speak to Hamas simply because Israel demands it. I'm a South African, and I recall that during the apartheid years, the Western governments spoke very freely to the African National Congress in exile and tried to negotiate a settlement between the apartheid regime and the African National Congress. That was an obvious course to pursue, but in the case of Gaza, the United States, the European Union, seem to be determined to exacerbate the situation by refusing to speak to Hamas.
Oh, indeed, John. And of course, it has to be pointed out, and certainly has many times in this program, that in January 2006, Hamas was democratically elected. They certainly are not a terrorist organization, but the U.S., often at the behest of Israel, will label organizations, be it Hamas, be it Hezbollah, terrorist groups. And the definition of terrorism by their standard is a group, an organization, a government that won't surrender its sovereignty to the U.S., to Israel. It's doubly ironic, John, that back in the 1980s, the PLO was the bad guy under Arafat, even though Arafat, I believe earlier than the 1980s, but certainly in the 1980s, extended an olive branch, wanted to end the hostilities, wanted to recognize Israel. Now, but you don't do it unilaterally. Hamas, numerous times, has been willing to recognize Israel. It never gets reported in the Western media, at least not in the U.S. I can't speak for Europe. But you don't do it unilaterally. I mean, you want them to recognize you in return. Hamas has made it very clear that in 1948, they lost 78% of their country. Israel took it over, even though the UN back then, John, in 1947, gave pre-Israel, the Jews, 56%. And how they came up with that petition, I don't know. The 56% for the Jews, they held out 2% back then for Jerusalem as an international separate city, because it's never worked out that way. And then the 1948 war, Israel seized 78% of historic Palestine, Gaza and the West Bank, including the settlements in the West Bank, comprise the other 22%. They want that 22% back, and they have every right to demand that they get it back. It's their land, it's their territory, but Israel will have no part of it. So Israel, as you say, has continued this settlement program in the West Bank, around 500,000 Jews there, Israel having no intention to leave, to pull out of those settlements. And I think at this point, John, we're way past the point of asking 500,000 people to pick up and move someplace else. I mean, that just isn't practical.
Well, of course, this has resulted in a movement in favor of seeking a single state solution.
Indeed.
And of course, this has disastrous, or will have disastrous consequences for Israel as a Jewish state. And I'm amazed that Israeli politicians do not see the situation in this light, because by settling 500,000 settlers in the West Bank and seizing 10% of the land by means of the construction of the wall, and there are also large areas of land in the West Bank that are seized as military reserves. The result is that there's very little land left in the West Bank, and certainly it becomes increasingly impossible to contemplate a viable Palestinian state within the remaining territory. And so for that reason, people are saying, well, let's push instead for a single Palestinian state, in which there will soon be a majority of Arabs, and that will be the end of Israel as a Jewish state. And I'm just very surprised that Israeli politicians do not see it in these terms.
As a Jew, John, I fundamentally cannot accept a state based on a religion. I was weaned here in the U.S. on the strict separation of church and state, and I fundamentally believe in it. here, I guess you could call the U.S. a Judeo-Christian state, a Christian Judeo state. A lot more Christians in the country than Jews, but there are members of other faiths. They're certainly not treated all that well, especially Muslims. And I've spent a great deal of time writing and having programs on the ill treatment of Muslims in this country, targeted improperly, illegally, because of their faith, their prominence, and so on, including very distinguished people like Samuel Arian, who I've had one program with his daughter on this program, but many others as well. Last week we had two programs on Muslim political prisoners, but still we are a state, a political state, not a religious state. So the idea of a Jewish state, Israel has no constitution, it has basic laws, but the laws are for Jews alone. They essentially give no rights to non-Jews, including Christians. We have another break coming, John.
Yes.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm on with John Dugard. We're talking about Israel-Palestine. John, I was just making a point that Israel has laws that provide rights for Jews, but not for, certainly not for Muslims, not really for Christians either, but especially Muslims. And Israel calls itself a democracy, but this isn't my definition of democracy.
I think Israel is a very complex society and a complex state. And I think it's important to bear in mind that there are many Jewish Israelis who are strongly opposed to the way in which the government behaves towards Palestinians. As special rapporteur, I relied very heavily on the investigations carried out by Israeli non-governmental organizations into human rights violations in the Palestinian territories. And in Israel, one does find that there is a vibrant debate about the future. And what troubles me is that in some societies, particularly in the United States, there's a taboo on criticizing Israel, which is not the case in Israel itself. And I think until the West overcomes its Holocaust guilt and is prepared to address the human rights record of the Israeli government and the Israeli Defense Forces, it's going to be very difficult to resolve the problem.
Oh, I agree with you, John, and very definitely, there's a huge taboo against criticizing Israel, especially among top officials. The Israeli lobby in this country literally has a stranglehold on the government. There are scattered people in the House of Representatives who voice criticism. These are people who pretty much have a lock on their districts. They'll get reelected pretty much no matter what they do. Not always, but maybe most of the time or lots of the time, but absolutely without question in the Senate. I quoted Edward Said, the great scholar, yes, died 5 years ago, who once made a statement. His words were something like, the entire Senate, 100 senators, can be brought together in a matter of hours to support Israel on virtually anything. Now, that really is astonishing. 100 senators, you could not marshal 100 senators probably to come together on anything in hours, days, weeks, months. But in hours, you could marshal the entire U.S. Senate to support Israel, right or wrong. Now, that's a pretty outrageous thing to have to live with. I mean, it's good. A senator would be vulnerable to be defeated. A House member representing a small district, that's a different situation. But even then, 435 in our House, John, and I don't know what the number is, but I probably could count the number of Israeli critics, even to a mild degree, on the fingers of one hand. That's pretty sad.
But I think that civil society is beginning to change in the United States and Europe. One sees that demands for sanctions, boycotts, divestment are growing in both the United States and Western Europe. And I think at this stage, governments resist the demands of civil society, as they did in the case of South Africa initially. But ultimately, I think that the strength of public opinion will prevail. Israel tends to believe that it can engage in a wonderful public relations exercise, which will succeed in concealing the truth. But that cannot continue indefinitely. And I think the war in Gaza, the conflict in Gaza, illustrated this very clearly. I think the public opinion was deeply disturbed by the images it saw of Israel's bombing and its conduct in Gaza. So I'd like to think that public opinion may be changing, even though governmental opinion is not.
I agree with you, John. It is changing, and I think Israel was shocked at the reaction around the world, with cities like London and Paris, much more in Europe than in the U.S., but even in the U.S., 60, 70 cities, large numbers of people came out to protest, not once, not twice, but a number of times. And I think in London, one of the protests, as many as 100,000 people came out on the street. Now, I live in Chicago. I couldn't imagine 100,000 people coming out on the street protesting what Israel did in Gaza. Israel's own soldiers are coming forward now. John, I'm sure you've seen this. I have a brand new article. It's all done, except for what I might add last minute. I haven't put it out yet. I will put it out this week. It has a lot in it, but it really features the testimonies of Israeli soldiers, both ones
who... I was in Gaza, I was really distressed to hear accounts from eyewitnesses of women and children who had been shot in cold blood in the head from a short distance. And I found it very difficult to accept. But now these stories have been confirmed by members of the IDF itself. And I think this is very disturbing. I know that the IDF has indicated that it will carry out some investigation into these allegations. But if one looks at the past record, it's unlikely that anything will be done, that there will be any prosecutions.
And oh, indeed, John. We need to take another break. We have a longer segment right after this. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Dugard. We're talking about Israel-Palestine. John, I must say that the Israeli press is a good bit more open than our major press here in this country. I quote from Haaretz all the time. You can find out what's going on in Israel by reading Haaretz, a major Israeli newspaper. And you can get it online. It's in English. And they've been running a series of articles quoting Israeli soldiers and also a group called Breaking the Silence, former Israeli soldiers who have contacts with others on active duty in the military. And they are telling a series of horror stories. Commanders giving orders to shoot innocent men, women, children, anything that moves, anything that's a Palestinian. And specific examples that I quoted. One very chilling account, they mentioned a Israel's head chaplain, the head rabbi, a brigadier general in the military, a Rabbi Avichai Ronsky, if I'm pronouncing his name right.
Yes, I know.
And he distributed booklet material. Apparently this goes to all the young recruits. And he said it was, quote, terribly immoral to show mercy to a, quote, cruel enemy, and that soldiers were fighting, quote, murderers. Now imagine a rabbi. I remember growing up as a young Jewish boy, John, and getting bar mitzvahed, and I remember the rabbi at my synagogue. He certainly didn't talk like this. I never heard a hostile word out of his mouth. he acted the way I would imagine any man of God should act. But here's a rabbi claiming to be a man of God and yet violating what I was taught as core Jewish dogma. This man preaches hate. He sanctions premeditated murder. He lies about innocent civilians. And he claims to be a man of God. I don't even want to call it an oxymoron, John. This is pretty outrageous.
Yes, it is. It's a very serious matter, and I just hope that the Israeli Defense Forces will investigate the inference of that particular rabbi on the attitude of soldiers. But I do think we have to face the fact that Israeli society, or some sections of Israeli society, tend to see Palestinians as non-humans, and so they are treated with absolute contempt. And one sees this not only in the conduct of military operations, but also in the treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank at checkpoints and in the relations between settlers and the Jews in the West Bank. So what one really needs is a major educational effort in Israel and, of course, in Palestine to try to overcome hostile attitudes towards each other.
Oh, indeed, John. Of course, from the point of view of the Palestinians, when you've been assaulted and brutalized and really either restricted or imprisoned or whatever for six decades, it's very hard to feel kindly about your occupier. I certainly wouldn't. So it's easy to breathe hate. If this is what Israel wants, it's doing a superb job of it. How can they possibly be winning over a people when they continue to brutalize them daily? In my new article, I quote that in the week ending March 18th, last Thursday, I believe, Wednesday or Thursday, late last week, the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, in the West Bank alone, John, made 39 incursions,
exactly.
Meaning they entered communities, they broke into homes, they arrested men and young boys, teenagers. They're not guilty of anything. They just seize them and are accused of whatever they're accused of. Often they're accused of nothing. They're simply seized anyway. Maybe Israel sees them as standing up for their rights and doing it publicly. And this goes on virtually every day, plus all those things you mentioned.
And, of course, what I think is particularly unfortunate is that last week Israel arrested a number of prominent Hamas leaders in the West Bank, clearly in retaliation for the fact that Hamas was unprepared to release Corporal Shalit on Israel's terms. I know some of the Hamas leaders are well-known negotiators for peace in the region, and I think it's really outrageous that they should have been arrested simply in order to score some political point. When it comes to prison exchanges, well, one has to realize that there are 11,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails who are mainly there for what one might describe as political offenses. And I think it's high time that Israel realized that one of the ways in which it should proceed, if it is serious about peace, is to release prisoners. I mean, this is what normally happens when states are serious about making peace.
Oh, indeed, John. To think that Israel has 11, 12,000, whatever the number is, nobody knows for sure except the Israelis, but it's a huge number. And they have the outrage to complain about Hamas holding one Israeli corporal. And I'm sure that corporal is treated better than the Palestinians in Israeli prisons. And I've written plenty about that as well, John. And it's well documented that the great majority of these prisoners, well, virtually all of them are political prisoners. There may be an occasional criminal in there for some reason or other, but basically they're political prisoners. The great majority of them are tortured, and I've quoted from the Israeli Supreme Court sanctioning torture, at least on the basis of what they call a ticking time bomb. The Israeli forces can call anybody a ticking time bomb. It doesn't mean they are. It simply means they've been called that. So on that basis, you can torture them.
A number of Israeli NGOs have conducted investigations into the treatment of prisoners, and they have alleged torture and inhuman treatment. So it's not as if these accusations are made from outside. They are coming from within Israeli society itself. And it's sad that the Israeli authorities do not take these accusations more seriously.
Of course, torture very much is a policy of my own country, John, to my great dismay, and it certainly was the case under George Bush. I wrote a very detailed article on it, and I let these people hang themselves. I discovered their own documents, their own memos, their own presidential executive orders, and you read this stuff, and it sounds like it's coming out of George Orwell. But it's real. You simply quote them on what they say, and it's very clear that the torture was sanctioned at the very highest levels of government. And just as sadly, John, after Obama in office a couple of months, not a single change has been made in this policy. And I've written about that as well, including Obama's intention to close Guantanamo. Well, at the same time, $60 million will be spent to triple or quadruple the capacity of a torture prison in Afghanistan.
Stephen, I have to leave to deliver a lecture in a few minutes.
Oh.
I want just to say thank you for inviting me, and I do hope that your listeners will realize the importance of public opinion. I think we've both spoken about that this morning, and it's essential that American society inform itself more fully about what is happening in the Middle East, because without information and without a change in public opinion, I think it's going to be very difficult to achieve peace in the Middle East.
Oh, indeed,
and,
John.
I'm delighted that you have devoted an hour to this subject.
And I'll finish out the hour after you leave, and I'll continue to discuss it. But let me just say this, and then you can run off. You did tell me you had to leave before the hour was up. Once your report is out, I do hope you'll come back and talk about what you're unable to discuss now.
Yes, certainly.
Oh, I would be delighted, John. It's been a very important discussion with you today. I admire your work greatly. We need a lot more John Dugatz. I would say that along with public opinion. John, I'll let you run off and give you a lecture. And I thank you very kindly.
Thanks.
Thank you, John.
Goodbye, Steve.
This is indeed a very, very serious issue, a very important topic. If we're talking about Middle East peace, if we're talking about Middle East, the Middle East is a pretty vast area, but of course we're still at war in Iraq. The country is still occupied. Afghanistan is not in the Middle East, but it would be in a greater area that's referred to as Eurasia. Afghanistan, there's still a war going on there. That country very much is occupied. Obama plans to increase the force greatly. I've seen various numbers thrown around. 30,000, doubling the number. I think there are 60,000 U.S. troops there now. Maybe wrong on that figure, but there's a good many. Tens of thousands of U.S. troops there. So it'll be increased another 30,000, another 60,000. It simply won't make any difference. That conflict will go on. Iraq will stay occupied. Terrible things going on there, plus occupied Palestine for all of these years since going back the 1948 war that really broke out in late 1947 and displaced, slaughtered 800,000 Palestinians that lived there for many centuries. And a band of a small group, really, certainly not reflecting all Jews in the world, but the Zionist segment of Judaism decided that this would be the new Jewish homeland. And over a period of decades, from early in the 20th century, managed to convince the British that had the mandate over the territory, and then later the Western world, really, primarily the U.S. The U.S. was the first country to recognize the new Jewish state minutes after it was declared, I believe, at just about midnight, May 14th, 1948. I believe it was May 14th. And I actually quoted from the short document that Harry Truman signed, he being president at the time. It was two sentences. And there was actually a couple of words crossed out, and he wrote in something else, didn't change the meaning. He signed it, and we recognized the new state of Israel, and it's been all downhill since. I've written a great deal about Zionism. I have another one on Zionism written that I haven't put out yet. But very early in the game, Zionism split, and the dominant militant side really won out against the more moderate side. And beginning with the first prime minister of Israel, it decided that it would use violence as its approach to the region, to the Arab world. This tiny Jewish enclave in the middle of a very large swath of territory, countries, Arab countries, primarily non-Jewish, not entirely. There are Jews in Arab countries, too, treated better than Israel treats non-Jews. Not at all. But in most of them, this has gone on for all of these years. It's very serious. Every U.S. government, it doesn't matter, be it a Democrat government, a Republican government, it makes no difference. What Israel wants, it basically gets. Not everything, but the power of the Israeli lobby. Without question, it's the most powerful lobby in Washington. It may not get everything it wants, but it comes pretty darn close. Pretty darn close. It's wanted a war against Iran, at least since the late 1980s. It has not gotten it. I certainly hope it won't get it. I lean against that happening, but who knows? There are powerful people who want it. The problem is there are powerful people lined up against them who do not want it. Because they realize, aside from the illegality of another war of aggression, the insanity of attacking a country like Iran, a lot stronger than Iraq. They can fight back. They certainly couldn't defeat us. But they have weapons. Those weapons could cause a lot of damage. And they certainly can disrupt things a great deal inside Iraq that has a majority Sunni population, the predominant Muslim religion of Iran. They could disrupt things considerably if they suddenly use their influence against the U.S. And if we attack them, or if Israel attacked them, Israel would never do it unless we gave it the green light. Hasn't happened yet. Hopefully it won't. But the whole Middle East will go up if that ever did. And despite all this, or along with this, you've got this long festering situation in occupied Palestine, where Israel simply disdains the rule of law, international law, sacred international humanitarian law, the laws of war. What would pass for its own laws, but it does what it wishes, plus numerous UN resolutions, the ones the U.S. didn't veto, other resolutions coming out of the General Assembly, that no country can veto, and Israel simply ignores every one of them. Oh, it's been condemned from time to time, but nothing takes hold. Israel, what Israel wants, Israel does, and it has very powerful allies. Basically, certainly the most important one, Washington, but the Western world, and every Arab state, save for Syria, and Lebanon, at least the portion of Lebanon that of the Hezbollah part of the government. Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. Most people have no idea about that. Iran is not an Arab country. Iran is former Persia. So call it a Persian state, not an Arab state. But it's part of the Middle East world. Iran certainly doesn't support what Israel is doing. But all of these countries would like normal relations with Israel. The Palestinians would certainly like normal relations with Israel. The problem is that Israel doesn't want normal relations with them. So Israel doesn't negotiate. It demands, just like Washington. It doesn't negotiate. It demands. Well, not everybody will go along with those demands. Sadly, most countries do. But the ones that don't become outlaw states or terrorist states. We have another break. We'll come back. I'll finish up the hour and tell you about my guest tomorrow. 3 live programs this week. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'll finish up the hour. Let me just tell you about the rest of the week. Tomorrow I'll have James Petras back on the program. He's pretty much a regular. And we may go in any number of directions. He is a Latin American expert, but he's pretty expert on the Middle East and so much else. He's a very long-time, very astute observer. So we'll have a free-ranging discussion of key things going on Wednesday. I'll have a very interesting guy coming on. His name is Keith Harmon Snow. Maybe most listeners aren't familiar with him. He is an investigative journalist, and his beat is Africa. He's worked in 17 African countries covering the conflicts that really make news in the U.S. But we'll talk about some of them, and Africa is getting to be a much more important country, continent. It always has been important because it's resource-rich, but some of the conflicts in places like Congo, Somalia, the issue is resources, and oil or other resources often dominate. Washington, the Pentagon, has a new command for Africa called AFRICOM. So we'll talk about what's going on. We can't cover the whole continent, 53 countries, I believe. But in the hour, we'll cover as much as we can. Let me mention one other thing about Israel-Palestine. In one of my articles, I quote from a CIA document that came out. And the CIA saying, in 20 years, Israel will not exist in its current form. And I think basically it's saying that Israel no longer will be a Jewish state. It'll be something else. And it had one other startling comment in it, that between now and then, 2 million Jews will leave Israel and come to the U.S. And I don't think they said it, but my interpretation of that is they're fed up, they want no more of it, and they want to get out. This conflict that they don't support, it's disrupting their lives, as it certainly is. So they want to come out to where they think they can live in peace. I'm not sure they're going to find it here. But this is their thinking. That is a very, very major outflow in a tiny country like Israel. A very, very large percentage of its population just moving out. Now, others will come in. But of that 2 million, they're talking about people that Israel does not want to lose. Doctors, lawyers, professional people. They want something else, somewhere else. I'm sure there'll be an exodus to Western Europe as well. And I've said so much. One statement that I quote again in my newest article, that history proves very conclusively that in any state that lives by the sword dies by it. Either Israel has to change its ways, or it may end up destroying itself. Now, that's what the president of Iran really said, Ahmadinejad. He never said his country, Iran, wants to destroy Israel. But he did say something to the effect that doing what it's doing, Israel will end up destroying itself. Well, I say the same thing. Others have said the same thing. And I believe it's true because history pretty well tells that story. It's happened numerous times in the past. You could make the same statement about our belligerency, our militancy, and all the money that we spend. If we don't bankrupt ourselves with these outrageous bailouts, the criminal bankers will surely do it on what we're spending on the military and militarism year after year. And we'll revisit those topics on future programs. Oh, there's so much to talk about. We're out of time now. But please come back tomorrow. Again, James Petras will be my guest. And I promise you a very, very important, interesting discussion. Come back and join us then.